You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, does your life feel optimized, honed for peak efficiency, personal, work, or kids' schedules carefully arranged for maximum productivity, diets juiced for balanced macros, etc.? If this is you, your life, does it feel like that's working for you? Do you think you're better off being as efficient as possible? Our next guest says that optimization is all around us, and not just at the daily personal level. Companies and organizations have been using optimization for generations, constantly trying to grow upward, outward, and better inward. The results, she says, have been lucrative up to a point, and they've come with lots of downsides. She toured the country finding examples of the impact of optimization and meeting people who resisted it one way or another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself as an optimizer in your work life, your personal life? Have you seen your workplace do some kind of optimization for better or worse? Or have you maybe gone off the grid in some way, picked a slower path, a slower pace of life and work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Coco Crummy is an applied mathematician and writer based in the Pacific Northwest. She's the founder of a scientific consultancy, and her new book is called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Coco, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, I want to talk about your origin story a little bit, because your career up to a point would have made you put you at ground zero of optimization as a mathematician in Silicon Valley. Where were you? What turned you away from that?
Well, you know, it goes back even farther still. I grew up in the Bay Area, sort of on the cusp of an earlier tech boom. And then I went east for college and grad school at MIT, which was another center of optimization, and came back to Silicon Valley when it was sort of roaring into the latest tech boom. And, you know, the book is a little bit a story of my own disenchantment with that world and how I made it from there to a remote Pacific Northwest island.
Now, can you explain this concept of optimization? Just set it up for people who haven't thought about it a lot. What do we mean when we say optimization?
Sure. Well, I like to start with a couple definitions. There's the technical one, and then there's the more colloquial one. The technical one is probably familiar to anybody who works in engineering or statistics, mathematics, and even the corporate world. And it's this idea of taking an objective function or something that you want to maximize and a set of constraints or parameters and solving that equation or that set of equations to get to the best outcome possible given your constraints. Now, the more colloquial definition is this idea of optimizing, of controlling the natural world in some way in order to lead a better life or make the best of what you have. And I argue in the book that mindset has, well, it grew out of technical roots, as well as some cultural origins in kind of the founding of our country. It's pervaded our daily lives in these incredible and enormous ways.
Yeah, it's reading your book, you know, I thought, okay, yeah, Silicon Valley or a big business or General Electric, of course, they're trying to optimize. But reading your book, I think about all the ways, all the things we see advertised to us as ways to optimize our diets or maximize the output of our time, even when we're not working. It's almost like an ideology has emerged where optimization is our optimal goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you spend any time in or around Silicon Valley, right, you see it everywhere, from billboards for technical things, optimizing HR or optimizing your servers, to really everyday things, right? You see it on vitamin labels. There is this sort of cult. I mean, you alluded to it being a religion, and I very much think it shares some features with religions or cults, right? But there's this cult in Silicon Valley of eating or drinking these products that allow you to get sort of optimal nutrition with the least amount of time and effort. So you kind of drink your diet and there's no attention to whether it tastes good, whether it's enjoyable, whether you're sharing that meal with people you care about, sort of the traditional reasons we would come together and eat in the first place beyond simply feeding ourselves.
Talking to Coco Crummy about her new book. It's called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coco, you were just hinting at something that I wanted to ask about, and you talk about a lot in the book, is optimization sounds like a rational process, but it starts with deciding what we want to optimize in the first place. And you spend time on North Dakota sugar beet farms a lot to in your research for the book and leading up to it. And you raise like, okay, if we want maximum yield, that's going to mean one thing for optimization. If we want maximum profit, that might mean something different. If we want maximum soil preservation, something different still. The list goes on and on. How important is it to figure out what we're trying to optimize in the first place?
Well, I mean, I think that's key. And, you know, at the same time, one of the rejoinders to this argument or to my book that I hear from the tech world especially, right, is that, okay, we can admit that optimization or the fruits of some optimization haven't necessarily been good, right? So if we optimize agriculture simply for yields and forget about soil regeneration, or we forget about the communities that optimized agriculture affects, then, you know, that maybe isn't the best thing, but the solution is simply to change what we're optimizing for. And while I think that can be helpful, certainly in certain cases, there's this larger embedded idea that we should be optimizing in the first place.
And can you talk about what you see as the harm of the optimization mindset in the first place? Whatever we're optimizing, how do you see it as having steered us wrong?
Yeah, and I'll first caveat all this by saying I'm often accused of being a Luddite. while that may be true in certain aspects, I don't think that optimization is all bad. I think optimization as a technology has created some incredible things, right? We wouldn't have the standard of living and the wealth that we have today in the West were it not for optimization. We wouldn't have the safety of certain engineered systems. We wouldn't have modern medicine and dentistry. The pitfall, I think you asked about the pitfall. I just want to make sure I'm
definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the pitfall is that we forget other ways of seeing the world, right? You look at a lot of cultures and historically and present day outside of our Western kind of corporate driven culture, and you see very different ways of approaching what one should do or what's right, right? These are often driven by cultural norms or ethics, morals, rather than what is the best or what is going to make the most money or, you know, whatever other variable you're optimizing for. And I think there's a certain richness that's been lost there, along with an increasing fragility that we see in many of our overly optimized systems. They simply break down more frequently than were they not so optimized.
Yeah, one of the things that really struck me was optimizing a system takes out slack in systems. Our ability to react to changes, to difficulties, to changing fundamental situations. Can you talk about our loss of slack as we optimize?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of a trade-off that's been pointed out from a lot of different disciplines. You know, in ecology, you have trade-offs between robustness and strength and fragility, right? or speed rather and fragility. When you think about something as simple as weightlifting or training for athletics, a lot of the building of muscle or of endurance happens not so much in the time of exertion, but in the time of rest, right? When those muscles regenerate and grow. And sleep obviously helps us regenerate. Without sleep or rest, we as organisms start to fail and collapse. And obviously in much larger systems like markets and the electric grid. So I argue in the book that one of the major things that we've lost, or the category of things that we've lost, as we optimize, is this, you know, this concept of slack or downtime or rest.
We're talking to applied mathematician and author Coco Crummy about her new book. It's called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about optimization and its problems? Have you experienced some of these negative impacts in your life of optimization, maybe at your workplace? Have you tried to opt out in some ways? Live off the grid, maybe? We'll talk about that in just a bit. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with author and applied mathematician Coco Crummy. Her new book is called Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Talk about how we became obsessed with efficiency, economies of scale, and how that obsession has brought a lot of negative impacts to people's lives, and maybe what we can do about it. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very philosophical, so I appreciate this discussion because I consider myself a minimalist, because when I lived out west in Pacific Northwest, Seattle, Portland, that area, I lived in group settings where we had more than one income in each living situation. And we would have group meetings discussing how can we optimize this resource or this service. And a lot of us just fell away thinking, you know, people are not a means to an end, but an end in themselves. And we really fell away thinking that it's kind of best to live a minimal lifestyle and do more with less.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Coco, your thoughts on Jeff's thoughts about humanity and optimization.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think it's a feeling that's emerging, or it's becoming more prominent in recent years. Obviously, the pandemic was a shock to a lot of systems, both large scale economic systems, as well as I think it led to reflection in a lot of people as to whether the path they were on was one that made sense for them. So what you said certainly resonates.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call. And that actually is a nice segue, Coco, to a lot of your book is talking to people who in one way or another try to opt out or push back against optimization in one way or another. Let's go back to sugar beet farmers. One farmer you talked to over the course of years was one amongst a co-op of farmers who said, I'm going to try not to go with genetically modified foods at that point. Economically speaking, easier said than done. Can you talk about the challenges he faced?
Yeah. And, you know, this was by no means a total back to the land kind of farming operation. It was a sixth generation farm that, you know, utilized a lot of fairly modern technology. And, you know, he just, the owner just didn't want to do GMO. And that in another era would have been a perfectly acceptable and economically viable decision. The problem is that this industry, as with many sectors of agriculture in the US, is that Sugar Beets is run by these co-ops. It's the supply chains are incredibly vertically integrated, right? The co-ops own the processing facilities. They own, in many cases, the transportation, the railroads, or the parts that get the product to the processing facilities. And if everybody else went GMO, there was no way for one holdout to have his crop processed into sugar. So he tried to find workarounds. And I won't ruin the or spoil the end of the story, but it was an arduous path for this particular farmer.
And another path, and you talked to some people, and to an extent, you've done it a little bit yourself, is the idea of, okay, I'm going to opt out. I'm going to live on an island, say, in the Pacific Northwest, or in some other way go off the grid. We can't all do that, though, I don't think. Can you talk about that back to the land concept you mentioned as a reaction to optimization?
Yeah. And, one of the places I land in the book, right, is that it's pretty much impossible for most of us to opt out. I mean, I'm less on the grid, but I'm certainly not off the grid. There's FedEx where I live, right? It may be a little bit slower, but it still exists. The internet exists. It might also be a little bit slower. And as you point out, it's also a choice that in many ways is a luxury today, right? I am lucky enough that I can do work, that is partially remote. That was the case even before a lot of the accommodations for remote work happened due to the pandemic. And that's certainly not the case for a lot, if not most people. And that said, even with that luxury, right, I am tied in all of these ways. So I think while there's this growing desire to slow down or disconnect in certain ways, I think it's a fantasy to believe that you can opt out completely.
Talking to Coco Crummy about her new book, Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Okay, if we don't like living in a completely optimizing world, but we recognize that we can't completely opt out of optimization, what do you recommend people do? How can we start to change our mindset to maybe pick our battles and where we could slow down and avoid the optimization?
Well, I think the first step is exactly what you said, Rob. It's realizing and being aware of how some of these forces work. The technical and cultural forces of optimization. I think for everybody, it looks a little bit different, right? If, some people are perfectly fine living in an optimized and optimizing world. It's thrilling in certain ways. And I certainly wouldn't recommend anything different for people who are content with that. I think for those of us who feel a certain malaise at the speed of things or the pervasiveness of this mindset, it's really about not opting out completely, but returning a little bit to first principles, first principles understanding of how these systems work, right? So I may not be able to buy everything, all my food, all my materials from my local community, but to the extent that I can understand where things come from and make conscious choices about the things that I'm buying from abroad or, that are made outside of my direct reach or using technologies, like I don't understand in minute detail how my computer works. but I've made that choice to accept some of those abstractions and those shortcuts because, it does help me do things that I feel are valuable in the world.
you mentioned from time to time talking to people who might have been your colleagues at MIT or Silicon Valley or wherever about these concepts. I imagine a lot of blank stares. How do you sell this idea of we should worry about optimization to optimization central in the high tech industry world?
Well, you know, I think it's actually gotten a little bit easier since I first conceived of this book, which was in around 2014, 2015 or so, when the tide hadn't yet turned against big tech, right? And we were all still in its enthralled and enchanted, right? We you know, and I'm speaking sort of the collective cultural sentiment was that Twitter and Facebook and Google were, you know, not only these magical innovations that were going to make their founders and shareholders rich, but they were literally going to save the world. They were going to save democracy. They were going to allow creative people to express themselves and find audiences. And I think some of that promise, those promises have perhaps manifested in certain ways, but the tide has really turned, you know, to the point where we see these companies as, you know, as profit-seeking corporations that they are. And so that certainly helped my argument. I think I get fewer blank stares nowadays. But, you know, that techno-utopian mindset is still very much alive. And I think time and history will tell, right, whether these promises of AI and automation and technology kind of saving ourselves from ourselves and granting infinite leisure time and, you know, infinite resources to everybody and equality, you know, and justice to boot, if that actually manifests or we see a sort of different future for technology.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Coco Crummy, talking about her new book, Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Tomorrow on Central Time, as deer season gets ready to start this weekend, there's concern about a declining number of hunters in the state. Find out why and what it means for deer management. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever heard people talk to each other in online video games or played a game yourself with live conversation or maybe followed the chat on game streaming sites like Twitch, you may have seen how toxic those environments can be, especially for women, people of color, and the LGBTQ community. They can be even worse than social media comments on, say, Twitter or X or Facebook. It can look like an anything-goes situation, but there have been some efforts by companies to create safer gaming spaces. The game company Ubisoft recently introduced their own Good Game Playbook, which outlines what good online conduct looks like and how gamers can protect themselves from harassment. Others have various types of moderation and reporting systems. Our next guest studies online communities and what can be done to prevent harassment and create positive spaces in online gaming and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you play online games or maybe do your kids? Do you follow game streamers? Have you witnessed or experienced harassment in those spaces? What kind of things would you like to see to create more friendly environments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Yvette Wan is an associate professor of informatics and director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Yvette, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, for people who haven't spent a lot of time in this world, whether playing, you know, live online games or following streamers on Twitch, can you give us a sense of some of the worst case? How bad can things get?
Well, we've talked to a lot of people who have been subject of these kind of harassment, and we've heard like really, really bad stories, including people who show up to people's houses in person because they somehow found their personal information. And then a lot of things that I don't feel comfortable talking about on public radio, but it really ranges from, you know, the mild name calling to very serious situations.
That seems like the solutions I've seen over the years in a lot of online platforms is A, do nothing. I hope it kind of sorts itself out. B, having reporting and maybe blocking mechanisms, things like that. I was interested in this thing from Ubisoft. We've seen other similar things where they're trying to say, hey, instead of just focusing on reacting, we're going to try to set the ground rules for positive interaction online. What do you think of that approach?
I think that's something that scholars have been advocating for a very long time, because the analogy I like to make is a park. Like, if you go into a park and there's garbage everywhere, then people will probably think, oh, it's okay for me to throw away garbage here, right? But if it's like very clean and pristine, then you might think twice about, you know, just throwing garbage on the ground. And so I think that's the same with online communities. Like, depending on what you think is the norm of what should be happening there, I think that influences people's behaviors.
I want to look at some of your research now, Yvette. You focused on Twitch streams and how moderation works. Again, for people who haven't participated in this, can you talk about, so if I set up a Twitch stream, I play a video game of some sort, and then people can type into a chat along the way. Can you talk about what moderation looks like in that kind of chat?
Right. Twitch is very unique. Of course, it's not just for game streaming. Like, any kind of live streaming is possible on Twitch. And what is a little bit different from other social media is that things happen in real time. So as the person who is broadcasting is delivering whatever kind of content they're doing, in real time, you see the comments on the, you know, on one side of the screen, and it's like moving very fast because people are talking there. And so that poses a very interesting challenge, because what that means is that as things are happening, you need to be aware of what kind of comments are happening in real time. And it's a little bit different from like posting on an online forum, for example, where there's like a slight delay between when somebody posts and when somebody sees it. So it's not only like a social challenge, but also a technical challenge as well.
And have you seen successful approaches to that, as you say, real-time moderation?
So I think, things are definitely getting better. Like, even in the past few years, we've seen a lot of improvement. The moderation on Twitch or any kind of social media is a very complex process that not only involves like technical solutions such as like AI, but also real humans. And so we have actual human beings reading the comments and making decisions on the fly about whether those should be deleted or reported, or whether the person should be removed or given a warning. And so Twitch has a very interesting structure where each stream has its own moderators. So in some sense, the governance of the platform is very decentralized. And so each streamer needs to decide how it is that they want to run their channel.
We're talking to Yvette Wan from the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at moderation of online communities, especially often toxic chats or conversations in online gaming and game streaming. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences, maybe something you've seen yourself or your kid has encountered. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. This is actually a great idea for the show. I have seen this myself. I'm an avid gamer. I've played a lot of online games where people, the vitriol on it is insane. It goes from the mundane, a couple swears, to just racist, homophobic, and it is sad. But like your expert Yvette was saying, that it's getting better. I see that a lot of times they're able to do live banning or live censoring of words. And then also when it's up to the players themselves and the viewers to do the reporting, that it's getting taken care of. I personally play a mobile game that's like Call of Duty, and whenever someone gets reported, the developers are looking into it, and they're actually looking at chat logs, and they're looking at video replays, and they're making sure that these people aren't doing anything that's against the rules or anything that is not acceptable. And also it even goes farther than just words and actions. It's more actions in game. If you're doing something that people don't like, they'll ban you for it. So.
Michael,
better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And Yvette, a few years ago, I know I'd heard from people saying, I don't even bother to report because I don't think anything is going to happen when I report. Is that, as Michael suggests, changing?
That's absolutely correct. I think the thing about content moderation is that companies are under no legal obligation to do this. And so for a very long time, they didn't do it because, you know, it takes a lot of money and resources to run that kind of program. But what they've realized over the years is that especially it's different now because a lot of games are online and social, right? As opposed to like 20, 30 years ago, where it was just like a person at home playing with their own computer. And so now they know that if they don't create a great environment, they're going to lose a lot of potential players.
Thanks again for that call. Michael, Yvette Wan is with us, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, talking about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces and other online communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories, whether they're from this morning or from years ago, of bad experiences in online gaming communities? Or have you had positive experiences? Have you seen things change over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Yvette Wan, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at harassment and abuse in online gaming spaces and efforts by companies and users to try and make those spaces less toxic, more friendly. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Aiden is with us in Green Bay. Aiden, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So it's really interesting that you're talking about Ubisoft in particular, because I actually was just playing a game by them this morning. I was called For Honor. And the reason why I left this morning was because of some toxic behavior. Someone got on the mic and just started basically reciting things from Hitler's manifesto, basically. And I was curious what the speaker had to say about, there used to be a game, I don't remember what it's called, but it had a system basically where you got 1 point for every match unless other people in the match upvoted you up to like 32 and it couldn't be your friends. And so what they use in this like system is basically every time you get a good behavior, you could get upvoted for it. And as a result, they had sort of like a more positive like community overall. But the thing is, that wasn't like a battle royale game where everyone was competing against each other. And so I was curious if she thought a system like that would work in some of like today's like service games, or if there's maybe a different way to go about it.
And thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, Yvette, that idea that he'd encountered in the past of positive reinforcement, I guess, if you behave well, people can vote for you, you get more experience points.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of game systems are incorporating more recently. And some of them are very overt, which means that you actually know what your reputation is based on the votes. And in other places, it's built into the algorithm, but you are not quite sure how it works because the company has hidden those metrics from you. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of like dual strategies, right? Like there's the punishment, but there's also the positive reinforcement.
And then there's Aiden's experience just this morning. He said somebody reading Hitler quotes, it sounds like. Some moderation systems can have a lot of gray areas. I think that seems like a pretty cut and dried and easy one. If you report that, there's a good chance somebody would be blocked.
Right.
I would hope.
I hope so. Some things are very clear and some things there's a lot of gray area. But another thing that I think Aiden mentioned that was really interesting is that this was like an audio situation, mm-hmm. right? When we look at like traditional text is very easy to monitor based on the technology that we have right now in artificial intelligence. So in some communities, for example, you can't even type out certain words. Like they won't even let you write it in because the system recognizes it as being toxic. But when we get to audio or behavioral things where, like, for example, you're moving around with your avatar in a certain way that is offensive, these are things that are harder for the computer to detect based on the technology we have today.
Thanks again for sharing that experience, Aiden. We'll go now to JJ in Two Rivers. JJ, hello.
Hello. So as an avid gamer, I see two double-edged swords in this topic. One being anonymity is meant to protect victims, but it also then makes it difficult to punish people. The second double-edged sword is that just like domestic abuse laws, you know, these are rules and guidelines are meant to help, but they can also be abused and taken too far. You want to talk about those two double-edged swords.
JJ, thanks for the call. So that first point, Yvette, trying to protect people's anonymity online, he says could protect victims, but then it makes it harder to block the people who abuse the system. If somebody gets banned, they can maybe just come in under another identity, and it's hard to track that. Is this part of the challenge?
Absolutely. Between anonymity and real name is what we call pseudonymity, and that's when you operate under a single username, but people cannot connect that with your offline identity. But even if you have a system like that, people can always use different emails to create new accounts and repeat the same behavior, right? So there are some systems that are trying to take measures against that, which include kind of trying to find detect behavioral patterns, like to see if, you know, even if it's a different account, if people are acting similarly, to try to match that based on IP or other kind of activities that they're doing. There are also ways that, for example, if you've just created a new account, like you have to wait a certain time period before you can engage in certain ways. And so there are more efforts to try to detect this kind of multiple account behavior. At the same time, when we're talking to the actual moderators, the human moderators, the things that they say that I think are really meaningful are looking at educating people rather than just banning them. Because if we look at people who are violators, there's different categories. And some people are really out there to do harm and there's not much you can really do about it. But then there are often like very young people or people who are just kind of not knowing completely what is appropriate. And instead of just banning those people and having them, you know, create a different account, there's increasing efforts in trying to educate mm-hmm. them about, like, you know, what is appropriate.
Thanks for that call, JJ. And JJ's other point, the possibility that reporting systems can lead to a different kind of abuse. And I think I've heard of this, Yvette, where a group of trolls who wants to harass that someone will, as a group, report their target as the abuser, even though they hadn't done anything in the first place. Does that make it harder to create systems that work?
Absolutely, especially when you have anything that is like user-based comments or reporting. Anything for a good purpose can also be used for bad purposes, right? And we see a lot of, we just released a paper recently on hate raids, which is looking at coordinated attacks towards other people, where so Twitch has this function where if you have a lot of viewers but you're ending your channel, you can send those viewers to another channel so that they can benefit from having more viewers. So that was like the good intention, but some people have been using this in a bad way, in which they send their viewers to a certain streamer to harass them. And so I think, like with anything in technology, I think there's always going to be these double-edged swords, and we just need to figure out, you know, how to make the best in these different situations.
We're talking about online harassment in gaming and other forums, online chats, Twitch streams, and more. Yvette Wan is with us with the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at ways to create more positive experiences along the way. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Steven is with us in Milwaukee. Steven, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I just want to say, like, I think it's also about, like, my son's 17, he does online gaming and stuff like that, and I play with sometimes too, but it's like, these people around you aren't real. And I told him, I was like, if someone says something offensive to you, just block them or leave. He's like, you have options. You don't have to, like, conform to, like, what's going on or be offended. Like, you can be upset for a second and be like, okay, this sucks. Then just get out or just block that player. Or these things exist in options. You can't just, like, they don't just, like, have these things where you're like, you had to put up with this stuff.
Gotcha. Steven, thanks for the call. Yvette, Steven said a couple of things I want to get into. First of all, he talked to his son about how to respond when he encounters this. And that, as I understand it, Ubisoft and some other companies, part of their coaching is how to behave well. Part of it is how to engage or not engage when you do encounter harassment or abuse or racist messages or whatever online. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, depending on which game you're playing, there are also options where you can mute a certain person if they're being rude. So then even if they're saying things, like, you can't actually hear what they're saying. So that is one way to deal with it. Another thing, especially I recommend for people with like very young children or teenagers, is like suggesting that they play with friends rather than just playing with the general public at first, because again, like, you don't know who you're going to be playing with.
And then Steven used the phrase also, these aren't real people. And I wonder if the abusers themselves, that's the mindset. Like, these are just things I'm encountering on the internet. Is that part of the goal of a positive training session, a positive message that, oh yeah, these are actual real people?
Yeah, I actually don't like to use the term like unreal for internet. And the reason for that is because what we perceive as reality, our brain isn't trained to say, oh, when I'm on the internet, this is not real. And when I'm offline, it's not real, especially for younger people, because technology and social media are embedded so much into their life. Whatever they do online is an extension of the reality. It's just taking place in a different venue. One nice way to think about it is, for example, like you at home and you at school, it's the same you, just in different environments, right? And so I think that, of course, it's easy to say, oh, you know, just, you know, brush it off because it's not anybody meaningful. But from the person who's hearing it, whether they hear it offline or online, it still has the same psychological impact and damage. So I think that it's important to understand that, like, what happens online, it's not unreal, right? It's very real. And in terms of your question regarding the violators, there are, like I said, there are a lot of different types of violators, and some people kind of view online as being, oh, this is, you know, a fictional scenario where I could do anything and get away with it, whereas other people don't make that distinction.
Thanks again for that call, Stephen. Christian joins us now in Eagle River. Oh, Christian just dropped off as we were going to take Christian. Yvette, I want to talk about who is most at risk, who is most targeted. I think again and again we see women, people of color, LGBTQ communities, particularly targets. How can we address that? How can we tackle that part of the problem?
I think one, like, the best way to think about this is that online is not particularly different from offline. So if we think about all the people who are vulnerable offline, including all the populations that you mentioned, including children, these are the same people who are going to be at the same risk online as well.
And Yvette, are you hopeful as we wrap up that we can create not just not bad online community experiences, but good and positive online experiences in the gaming community and beyond?
I am hopeful. However, I do understand, like, you know, as people, there will never be a situation where there's nothing bad, right? Mm-hmm. However, I am hopeful that as more people become familiar with this new technology, that they will understand that, you know, this is not a separate place where you can do whatever you want. It is an extension of our physical reality. But I also think that, kind of same with not just gaming, but like social media or other online activities in general, is that, you know, we can't completely just rely on companies to handle everything. And I think that, yes, companies should have a responsibility to do that. But I think also, you know, more education about, like, you know, how to conduct yourself online needs to be done at much earlier ages. And that's why I think we're also seeing a lot of improvement, because, for example, like when I was in school, like I never learned about, like, you know, how to conduct myself online. But kids these days are receiving that kind of education. So I'm cautiously hopeful that in the future, people will see this as an extension of our physical reality and treat it with the respect that it deserves.
Yvette, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Yvette Nguyen, director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. We talked to her about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces. This is Central Time.